So we started the third parak actually, and we're trying to get at our head wrapped around a machlokas here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And Rabbi Meir seems to give a tremendous amount of power and leeway to the baldin, to the two litigants in a monetary case, allowing them, as it were, to object and veto not only the appointment of judges, which you'll see here in the first part of the Mishnah, where it says, "Ushneim borim lehem od echad," that they both litigants have to agree on the third judge, which is the shita of Rabbi Meir. But then the Mishnah goes even a step further, and the Mishnah says that each, according to Rabbi Meir, each Baal Din has the right to disqualify the Dayan that was presented by the other Baal Din. And the word posel here, which you'll see on line 4 in the Mishnah, do you see that? Ze posel Dayano shel ze, indicates that he could really declare the psul, the disqualification of a dayan, which really makes no sense at all, because you would need objective evidence to indicate that someone is posel. Let's say to say someone is related to one of the litigants or one of the other judges, or he's a rasha. You know, he's guilty of certain sins that disqualify him from judgment. How does the Baal Din have any sort of authority to establish a psul and invalidate the status of a judge? And
today this is more like arbitration. Each litigant chooses one person, and then they choose a third person.
Right.
Sort of same thing.
Right. So that's one chiddush. But could you imagine if somebody presents his candidate to be a judge, right? Let's say the two litigants, Reuven and Shimon. So Reuven presents Yankel Berel and he says he's a great judge. I want him to be on the court. And comes along Shimon and he says, no, Yankel Berel is a rasha. He's an evildoer. Or he says about Yankel Berel that he's related to me or to you or to one of the other judges. I mean, how does he have the believability, the credibility to say about a judge that this judge is possible? Then the plot grows even thicker. The Mishnah goes one step further, and it establishes, according to Rabbi Meir, Zeh posel edov shel zeh, v'zeh posel edov shel zeh. Meaning that Rabbi Meir holds that each litigant could say about the witnesses that were brought to Beis Din by the other litigant that these witnesses are psulim. You know, they're related, they're evildoers, you know, they violated an... There's an amazing amount of power and authority, according to Rabbi Meir, that seems to be vested in the litigants, in each one of the two litigants. And it seems to go beyond our understanding. So hopefully, by the end of this morning, we'll have at least the beginning of a clue as to how to understand Rabbi Meir. So let's just see where we're up to. We are towards the bottom of Daf Chaf Gimel Amud Aleph, and we got up to a little bit earlier than that. Just let me see. It should say V'ha Edim. Let's see if I can find that. Just one second. You know what, I think what we should do is we'll be best off maybe if we start with the two dots, and that is the third of the wide lines. Do you see the wide lines on the bottom of the Amud if you have the same Tzuras Hadaf?
Yeah.
So the beginning of the wide lines is three lines down is Ze Posel Dayano. You'll see the two dots there. Okay, so the Mishnah says that according to Rabbi Meir, each one of the litigants can make a declaration that's actually valid and determine that the judge that was appointed, or the candidate judge that was appointed by the other litigant, is possible. So the Gemara says, how do you understand Rabbi Meir? Kol kmini de posel dayone? Kol kmini means, does he have the power to disqualify a judge? We have no objective reason or evidence to indicate that this judge is disqualified. Omar Rabbi Yochanan, biarkos shebesuria shanu. That the statement of Rabbi Meir is limited to the case of an area in the world where the judges were known to be unfamiliar with the law, with the halacha. Right? You and I know that the halacha is very complicated. Right? You can point to all the libraries and that contain the books, the volumes upon volumes of Jewish law. And you need what's called a baki. A baki means an expert in Jewish law. And in this place, there were courts, Jewish courts in Syria, in the northern part of Israel, and they were known to be a little bit sketchy, if you know what I mean. They weren't such scholars. And since the law of Chazakah would not apply in Syria. What does it mean, the law of Chazakah? The rule of Chazakah tells me that you are assumed to be on the up and up unless there's evidence to the contrary. So all over the world, the Jew who sits in judgment is assumed to be a baki. He's not a chutzpin yak, that he has such audacity to sit in judgment and he doesn't know anything. But unfortunately, as the situation evolved in a place called Syria, the courts were made up of judges who were people off the street and didn't really know the laws of the Torah. And therefore, the Baal Din has a right to say that this judge is not on the up and up. He doesn't deserve, he's not suitable to serve as a judge. Aval, however, mumchim. In other words, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, the assumption is that anyone who's sitting in judgment, if he took that upon himself to wear the mantle of judgment, he must be a mumcha, he's an expert. Lo. In such a case, even Rabbi Meir agrees that the litigant cannot say, I declare that this guy is posel. He doesn't know anything about the Jewish law. So the Gemara says that's a very nice interpretation of Rabbi Yochanan, but it doesn't fit into the language of the Mishnah. V'hamida k'tani, if we look in the Mishnah says in the Sefer, the end part of the Mishnah says, quote, v'chachamim omrim emasai. The Chachamim say, under what conditions do we disqualify a judge? Bizman shemevi raya, if and when the litigant can bring evidence, clear-cut evidence, reliable evidence, shehem, that these judges are krovim, are relatives, or psulim, or they are, as we said before, evildoers, like they're guilty of averos, and therefore they're disqualified as judgment. Aval im hayuk sherim, but if we have every reason to believe that they are suitable and they qualify as judges, or if they're mumchim mipi bezdin, as they received what's called smicha, so they've been recognized with documentation that they are experts in the law, then eino yochel leposlam. Then for sure, the litigant doesn't have the ability and the authority to disqualify them. This is the Chachamim. Now, if the Chachamim are turning to Rabbi Meir and they're saying, no, Rabbi Meir, you're wrong. Your assumption, your premise that the litigants have the right to disqualify judges is incorrect. Michlal, it implies that Rabbi Meir himself, if they were arguing against him, mumchim nami kavar, even in the case of someone who's got the qualifications, he has been ordained by the Beis Din as a judge, he's a mumcha, he's an expert. Nevertheless, Rabbi Meir holds that the litigant has the authority to disqualify him. And that's why the Chachamim, when they disagreed with Rabbi Meir in that Mishnah, they said that if the judges are mumchim, they have the expertise, then certainly the litigant is not able to disqualify them. Apparently, Rabbi Meir held that even in that case, where the judges are mumchim, the litigant could still declare, "I'm not going to be judged by this person. He's not suitable for judgment." So the Gemara now reinterprets the Mishnah. Hachi kamar. This is how you have to read the Mishnah. Aval im hayuk sherim. In other words, if we have no proof or evidence to disqualify the witnesses, is then nasu, we consider them kimumchim mipi bezdin. It's as if they have the ordination and the documentation that testifies to the fact that they are experts. V'eino yochel aposlam, and therefore the litigant cannot posel them. But the real controversy between Rabbi Meir, who allows the litigants that rope, that they can disqualify the judges, and the Chachamim say no, they cannot. That's the case of ksherim, meaning where there's no proof that, or documentation that the judge is an expert, and therefore the litigant can say, you know, I know that he's not an expert. So again, why don't we test him? Maybe we should just give him an exam. I don't know. But at this point, the Gemara is saying that even Rabbi would agree that if you have someone who's a mumcha, that means he's established with ordination as being an expert in judgment, and the courts have tested him, and they attest to the fact that he's an expert, then Rabbi would agree that in such a case, the litigant has no authority to disqualify the judge. So now the Gemara is going to make another attempt at proving that Rabbi Meir gives the litigant that authority to disqualify the judge, even in the case of mumchim. Toshma, here's a braisa. Listen to this braisa. Omru lo, the Chacham turned to Rabbi Meir, and they said, lo kol heimenu sheposel dayan shemumcha l'rabim. And lo kol heimenu means he doesn't have the authority to disqualify a judge who's a mumcha l'rabim. It says explicitly here that even though he is a mumcha l'rabim, he's known, he's been recognized, you know, he has the ordination, he has this big, you know, this big plaque that says, I am a mumcha l'rabim, I've been accepted and recognized as such, then he's not believed. And this is the Chachamim who are talking to who? To Rabbi Meir. Apparently Rabbi Meir himself, in that very same scenario, would have said that the litigants do have the authority to disqualify even someone who is a dayan mumcha l'rabim. So once again, the Gemara is going to try to push this into the language, in this case, of the Braisa. Ema, perhaps we should say that this is what it says in the Braisa. Lo kol heimenu, he doesn't have the power, this is the Chacham turning to Rabbi Meir, sheposel dayan shehimchu rabim aleihem. It doesn't mean that he has the ordination, and he's been recognized and ordained as a full-fledged expert that he can serve as a judge, but rather it means that the people themselves recognize him as he's a mumcha. He's never been tested, he's never been ordained, he doesn't have any certification from the courts themselves, from the judges, but himchu rabim aleihem, the people have often turned to this person and they have appointed him to serve for them as a judge. So Rabbi Meir says, no, that's not enough. It's not enough to establish the status of the and the expertise of a judge based on the fact that in the past people have accepted him and have appointed him, and he has expertise and experience. No, 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 no. He's got to have that formal recognition. If he's not what you call a dayan mumcha l'rabim, then the litigant has the ability to disqualify him and say that I know he's not an expert. Tanya Nami Hochi. Now the Gemara brings a brice on the contrary to prove and support the position that in the case of Mumcha L'Rabim, someone who's already been ordained, Rabbi Meir admits that the litigant cannot disqualify him. Tanya Nami Hochi. It says, Li'olam posil v'holech. And this braisa now is reflecting the sheet of Rabbi Meir, the way that we saw Rabbi Yochanan interpret Rabbi Meir. Li'olam posel v'holech. Any one of the Bali Dinim has the ability to disqualify the judge that was appointed, that was suggested by the other litigant. Ad she kabel olav bezdin shemum chalarabim. Until until the judge that's been suggested to sit on the court by one of the two litigants is a judge that has the status of a mumche l'rabim, divrei Rabbi Meir. So it means that if he has the status of a mumche l'rabim, and he has been appointed as such, recognized as such, he was tested, he got the documentation, the certification, as we said before, then Rabbi Meir himself would agree that the litigant has no authority to disqualify him. This man has the credentials, and you cannot undermine his status. Even Rabbi Meir would agree. So the Gemara says, but let's go to the next case in the Mishnah, via Edim. Rabbi Meir says that the Baldin, the litigant, has the authority to disqualify even the witnesses that were brought by the other litigant. And Kimumchim Dami, they have the same status as a person who's been ordained as a judge. Now, what's the similarity here between two witnesses and a person who was ordained by a judge? In both cases, the halacha relies on them. The halacha doesn't require that you be ordained as a witness. The halacha just says that every Jew has a chazaka. We assume that he's a valid witness unless he's proven otherwise. You know, you're innocent until proven guilty. And therefore, you, for all intents and purposes, as a witness, when you come in to testify, your status is the same as a dayan who's been ordained to sit on a court and serve as a judge.
In knowledge? In breadth of knowledge?
No, just in the honesty and credibility of a person who says that I witnessed, you know, Reuven Bar at 1,000.
He's a kosher Jew.
Every Jew is a kosher Jew, unless we know otherwise. Right? That's something like, I know, Chana, you have a relationship to Hasidus, correct? Yeah. In Hasidus, I would say that's the whole fundamental point of Hasidus, that every Jew has, and even the Litvaks in this case, although they're not Hasidim, they are influenced by the Hasidim, so to speak. I don't mean that literally, but what I mean to say is they came up with the same idea, that if a person comes to testify in a court that he witnessed a loan, right, some sort of monetary transaction, we believe him. We have no reason to assume he's lying, he's perjuring himself, or that he's disqualified for any reason. He doesn't need an official ordination. In the case of a judge, maybe we upgrade his status because he's been tested and we know he's an expert in the law. But the witness should have, there should be no difference between your average Joe who comes to testify in a court and a judge who has the credentials to testify. You know, he has the 5-8 kaf, you know, he has the official ordination. He's got his big mumcha l'rabim document that's on the wall. And yet, Omar Rabbi Meir in that Mishnah says, Zeh posel edov shel zeh, v'zeh posel edov shel zeh, that each one of the litigants can disqualify the witnesses of the other litigant. So you see that Rabbi Meir is giving absolute, unlimited authority to each one of the Bali Dinim. If each one of the Bali Dinim could say, I don't want these Edim are psulim, and we accept that claim, and therefore the Edim are now disqualified, then he can say the same thing to a Dayan, even though he's been ordained as such, as a Mukhal Rabbim, I don't want to accept this judge, he's not reliable. So the Gemara now quotes Reish Lakish. You know, things are really getting out of hand here with Rav Meir. You know, we're big fans of Rav Meir. You know, I live here on a street called Rabbi Meir Street, and this is the second apartment that I'm living in on the same street called Rabbi Meir. So my history with Rabbi Meir goes back a long time, but things are getting out of hand over here. This makes no sense. That you bring in two witnesses to support your claim that I owe you 1,000, and I say no, these are disqualified witnesses. Or a mayor says, I mean, you've eroded, you've undermined the whole system of justice. Anytime you bring in witnesses, I'm going to just say, well, I know the psulim. I have Ruach HaKodesh, and I got the word from on high that these are a bunch of bums or they're related, etc., etc. So the Gemara now quotes Reish Lakish. Ha'itmar Allah. We have a very important comment on Rabbi Meir and his statement in the Mishnah, his position in the Mishnah, in the name of Reish Lakish. Om Reish Lakish. Pek Hadosh. Yomar Dover Zeh. You have to read it with the inflection of a question mark. This is like, this is a... a statement out of amazement. It's a rhetorical question. Could it be that a holy mouth like Rabbi Meir? And by the way, there's a whole discussion here why Rabbi Reish Lakish, when he refers to Rabbi Meir, he calls him the holy mouth. And the Gemara is later on is going to discuss this. Why Reish Lakish used that term, Peh Kadosh, the holy mouth, to describe Rabbi Meir. Yomar Dover Zeh? He could say such a thing? How could these words come out of a holy mouth? That a Baldin could passel up two witnesses without any proof, just because he's not happy, he doesn't like the way that they testify on behalf of the other litigant, to the effect that he has to pay 1,000. But rather, says Reish Lakish, to me, what we should interpret the Mishnah, when the Mishnah says, according to Rav Meir, Zeh posel edav shel zeh, and the word edav means two witnesses, which if you take that literally, it means that according to Rav Meir, the litigant can say about two witnesses that they're both disqualified. You should interpret as edav. In other words, take out the yud in the word edav, and you end up in the singular. There's one witness. In other words, the other Baldin, we'll call him Reuven, he brought in one witness, and Shimon says, that witness I know is disqualified. He's not kosher liedus. Which means, according to Reish Lakish, certainly Rav Meir would agree that if the other litigant, we'll call him Reuven, had adduced two witnesses, then for sure, hands down, the case is over and Shimon lost his case. There's clear-cut evidence of two witnesses against him. But if Reuven only was successful in bringing how many witnesses?
One.
Only one witness against Shimon, then Shimon has the right to say, according to Rabbi Meir, we cannot rely on this aid, on this single witness.
You can't rely on one aid anyways. You have to have two to begin with.
Excellent.
A case of soda for some reason.
Excellent. Eido lamai. What is this one witness coming to testify? And the Gemara presents a kind of imanafshach. It's no matter how you slice the cake, you're in trouble here. Why? Elam, if we'll suggest, limamon, that this witness is coming to testify against Shimon, that Shimon owes Reuven 1,000. Rachmana pasle. The Torah already excluded this one witness. And this is based on a pasuk in Parshas Shoftim, there the Torah says, "Lo yakum eid echad beish," that one witness is not enough to testify. So I don't need Shimon to disqualify the single witness of Reuven. The Torah already said we don't rely on one single witness. Ilishvua, what does ilishvua mean? Right, the Torah does rely on one witness. Let's say a witness comes to support the claim of Reuven against Shimon that Shimon owes him 1,000. Lishvua. Shimon is now obligated, and I think we've discussed this in the past, to take an oath against the one single aid. So maybe what's happening here in Rav Meir's frame of reference, and this is what Reish Lakish had in mind by changing a dove to a doe, is that when Reuven brings one single witness against Shimon, and Shimon says he disqualifies that witness, then Rabbi Meir says he doesn't have to take an oath. Meaning the one aid which the Torah relies on, if he qualifies as a witness, as a kosher witness, is able to generate a chiyuv shvua on the other litigant. In this case, Shimon has to take an oath to contradict the testimony of the one aid. And now comes along Rabbi Meir, and he says, you know what, the litigant Shimon could say, I know that this witness is disqualified. So he's only attacking one witness who really doesn't have a full-fledged reliability in the Torah in Dinit Mominus, because he's only one single witness. So the Gemara rejects this as well. Why? Hey Mone Mehem in Kibetre. Hey Mone, we believe him. Mehem, that he's believed. Kibetre is like two witnesses. So as far as Mamon is concerned, to make Shimon pay the fee, pay the money, you need two witnesses, and one witness is not enough. But as far as requiring that Shimon take an oath to support his claim that he doesn't owe this money, he paid it back or whatever it might be, there the Torah says that one witness is believed like two witnesses. And therefore, once again, we're back to Reish Lakish, back to square one on Reish Lakish's objection to Rabbi Meir. How could Rabbi Meir say that I get rid of this one aid, this one witness, and I declare that he's disqualified, and if I don't have to take a shvuah? The Torah believed one aid as if he was two witnesses in order to generate a chiyuv shvuah.
Does the aid have to swear also?
No. He's believed just by virtue of his testimony. Li'olam says the Gemara Limama. Let's go back to our original understanding that we're talking about a Baldin, meaning Reuven, who brings a witness Limama to testify that Shimon owes him $1,000. And you'll ask, well, why do I need Shimon to say, well, I don't accept this witness, he's not acceptable, he doesn't qualify? After all, the Torah itself doesn't accept this one witness. Lo tzricha, what do I need it for? The case of the kabli alai kebetre. Alright, so this is a bit of a sugya. First we'll translate the words of the Gemara, and then we'll try to understand the concept behind these words. The kabli is in past tense. He has already accepted alai upon himself, kebetre, like two witnesses. So who's the he? You know, the pronoun H-E. Who are we referring to that he accepted upon himself this one witness as if he were two witnesses? Oh. So it turns out like this. When Reuven comes into Beis Din to sue Shimon for $1,000, and he claims he has a witness to support his claim, he was there at the time that Shimon borrowed the money, Shimon said, you know what? If you can produce this aid, this one witness, and get him into Beis Din, I'm going to accept him, and I'll rely on him, and I'll pay you the money. In other words, he already accepted this one witness as if he were two witnesses. Now, how can that happen? The Torah says that in all the laws of judgment and justice, there are certain objective laws, but those objective laws can be broken, they're pliable and flexible in a case where the one litigant who stands to lose is willing to accept upon himself a new set of rules which will work against him, if you follow what I mean. In other words, if I'm bringing this witness against you, I can't say, well, he should be believed like two witnesses. I don't have the power to do that. But if I'm bringing this witness against you, you as the defendant, you have a right to say, you know what? If you can prove it to me with this one witness and he'll testify, I'll accept him as if he was two witnesses. You know, it's like the Prime Minister saying, I'm not afraid of judgment because I know I'm innocent, you know. Which I don't know I'm still a little confused as to whether that's a sincere statement, but anyway, although I'm a big fan of the Prime Minister, but anyway, if a person says, you know, if you can bring one witness, you know, that can testify on your behalf that I owe you $1,000, then I'll pay you the $1,000. I'm going to accept him as if he's two witnesses. Now, to what extent is that declaration absolutely irreversible? Once the words came out of your mouth and you made that Kabbalah, you know, you accepted upon yourself. So this comes under the principle of Hodas Baldin, that let's say you come into Beis Din and you say, I owe you $1,000. So I say, yeah, I owe you $1,000. And then I decide to deny it, you know, and I want to rescind my original admission. So the law is that once you make that admission, it's binding and it's irreversible, irretractable. Are you with me on both sides?
It's on the record.
It's on the record. And it's had its impact. Here in this case, it's a little bit different. Why? Because Shimon, who's the accused, right? He's the defendant, he never admitted that he owes the $1,000. But what he did was, he made a statement in which he accepted one witness as if he were two witnesses. Can he rescind and retract his original commitment, his original declaration? And Rabbi Meir wants to tell us here that he has that flexibility. Again, he never admitted that he owes the money. He admitted that, or accepted upon himself, that one witness could be believed like two witnesses. And now he changed his mind. And he says, no, I don't believe one witness. Has he already in a sense, etched in stone his acceptance of one aid as if he were to aid them in such a way that it's irreversible. And here's where Amir says, no, it's not etched in stone. You know, he made a comment, he was a big shot, you know, he said, yeah, let's see if you can bring in one witness. Well, I'll trust one witness. And at the end he says, you know, I don't trust this one witness. I need two witnesses. So Amir says he's allowed, he's within his authority, this litigant, we'll call him Shimon, to revoke his original statement. He can backtrack from his Kabbalah. By the way, on the side, it's very interesting, in the Dorim, in the laws of vows and pledges, you can't just change your mind and say, oh, yesterday I said I wouldn't smoke, today I said, well, I decided I'm going to smoke. No, you have to go through a whole process to be matir the neder. And here, Rabbi Meir is giving a very broad, shall I say, right or legal opportunity for the litigant to change his mind and reverse his original commitment.
But has he sworn, or has he just,
no.
or just accepted that?
He accepted this one witness as if it was two, which would mean now that he doesn't have the option to swear. He's going to have to pay based on the testimony of one witness. But now he says, you know what? Nothing's happened yet. I decided... no go. I'm not going to be held responsible for a couple of words that I declared. So the Chachamim are going to say no blacks, no backs touch blacks, right? You know, you made a statement. You accepted one aid is two aid. You can't go back on that. And Rav Meir says no, he can go back on that. So this really now becomes in a sense, the pivotal point of the entire sugya. We've really cracked open a very tough nut, you know, a coconut. You know, we've broken it. Why? Because Pekadosh, how could Rav Meir have ever said such a thing that a witness can be disqualified by the litigant? And of all people, the litigant who serves to lose as a result of this the testimony. So the answer is we reduce it to one witness. No, so if it's one witness, why do I bother with the litigant? He doesn't have to disqualify one witness. The Torah disqualified one witness. And the answer is this is a case, a very unique case, in which the litigant accepted upon himself the testimony of one witness as if he is two witnesses. And now he's not in the mood. You know, I changed my mind. And Rav Meir says he could change his mind. So the Gemara now at this point says that we have a problem. Why? Because there's a Mishnah later that formulates this very exact principle. And it doesn't make any sense that the Mishnah at the beginning of the Perek and the next Mishnah, which is the second Mishnah, which is coming down the line, should reiterate the same principle. When Rebbe authors the Mishnayos, he doesn't have anything that's superfluous. He wouldn't repeat what he already had. So the Gemara says, Maika Mashmalon, what are you teaching me? What is Rebbe Meir notifying me that I didn't know? Dematzi Hadarbe, that when a litigant makes a commitment above and beyond the letter of the law, that he can change his mind and rescind his original commitment. Tanina, we know this from the Mishnah later on. This Mishnah is on Daf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph. Amalo, one Baldin says to his friend, Neman Alai Abba. My father is acceptable for me as a judge. Or Neman Alai Avicha. He turns to the other litigant. He says, I will trust your father to be a judge. Now, normally a parent or any other relatives is completely disqualified as a judge. But as I said before, the laws are given in a strict way, objectively, and there are very limited, strict regulations and limitations, but only in a normal case, in a case where the litigants themselves have an agreement that we want to change the rules of the game, and we're willing to accept upon ourselves a different set of rules. For example, we're going to accept the judgment of a relative, a father, or and so forth. Well, here's another case. Nemonim alai shlosha roe bakar. Three shepherds. Now, in the Gemara's language, a shepherd is a catchphrase sociologically for someone who doesn't know the law. You know, he doesn't study the legal texts. You know, he's busy out in the fields, you know, shepherding his flock of sheep or whatever it is. And now the litigants say, Nemonim Olai. Well, one of the two litigants said, and both of the litigants, they agree that this Roe Bakar, who really doesn't know the law, he's not a Baki, if you remember that word, and technically he certainly is disqualified to serve as a judge, but nevertheless the Baal Din, or the two Baal Dinim agreed that we'll accept his judgment. Now, all of a sudden, after they agreed, one of them decides he wants to pull out. He changes his mind. He wakes up the next morning and he says, you know, we're about to go into court, into judgment. I don't want to accept this judge. Rabbi Meir Omer Yochel Lachzer, Rabbi Chachomim Eino Yochel Lachzer Bo. So the Mishnah on Daf Chav Dalet, the very next Mishnah we're going to learn, records a machlok stream Rabbi Meir Chachom. Rabbi Meir says, okay, he made that commitment, now he changed his mind. And the Chachom say, no, it's etched in stone. It's irreversible. And now we're going to turn to Chav Gimel Amid Beis. The Omar Rav Dimi, Breder of Nachman, Rav Dimi, the son of Rav Nachman, Breder of Yosef, who's the son of Rav Yosef, that what it says in the Mishnah, that they accepted the father as a judge, Kigo de Kabli Ale Bechat, that this is a case where it's two strikes against you. What do I mean by two strikes against you? No, I'm sorry. To kabli alei kechad means there's only one strike against you. Sorry. What it means is the following. They already have two judges who are qualified. They're not related. But they need a third judge. So they decide, as with a consensus of both litigants, that they'll accept as a third judge someone who's not qualified as a judge. He's a father of one of the two Baal Dinim. And he'll make up the third member of the court. And this is a case where the mayor says that since despite the fact that he accepted as a judge his father or Yenim's father, he can change his mind. Yochel Lachzer. So again, now we're up to the following problem. We have two Mishnayos, the first and the second. And the way we interpreted the first Mishnah now, it's really saying exactly what we're going to learn in the second Mishnah. Why? Because we're saying that Reuven brings in one witness. Now, is one witness, according to Torah law, reliable to force someone to pay money? No. But the other litigant said he's acceptable. I'm accepting him as if he were two witnesses. And then he changed his mind. And Rabbi Meir says he can do just that. He can change his mind. Now we have the next Mishnah which says that when they were ready to appoint the third judge to the court, there was a consensus on the part of both litigants that even a father could sit in judgment. He could fill in that third spot as a judge. Now, one of the two litigants pulls the plug. You know, he revokes his original statement, and Rabbi Meir again says he's allowed, he's within his rights to do so. So the Gemara now is embarking upon a deep, profound analysis. What's the difference between the two cases? Why do I need both cases? Do we have the two cases? Let's jot it down so we have the two cases. Case number one in our Mishnah is where the litigant says, I'll accept one witness as if he were two witnesses, and that now he changes his mind. Case number two in the next Mishnah is where they accepted a father as a judge, and now he wants to change his mind. Utsricha. The Gemara says, I need both. Now, keep in mind, whenever you see the word tsricha, it's got to go in both directions. It's not enough to say, well, if I only had this, I wouldn't know that. You have to say in both directions. If I didn't know X, I wouldn't know Y, and if I only had Y, I wouldn't know X. So that's always the truth. He says the following. The Itana, if I only had the second Mishnah, Abba v'Avicha, where they accepted upon themselves a father as a judge, Behaka Amri Rabbanan, here's where I would understand the Chachamim. Now let me take a break for a split second, just as a, to, you know, so we can have a smooth landing over here. In the case of Neman Alai Abba, that I accept my father as a judge, what is the status of my father if he wasn't my father, if you follow what I mean? Could he judge in another case? Not in a case where I, his son, are involved in the litigation. And what's the answer?
Yes.
He's got all the credentials as a judge. So here, the Chachamim say, if there's just a technical barrier here, where the halacha regulates that a father cannot serve as a judge, really the father is great. You know, he's a scholar, he knows the law. In any other case, in any other litigation, he would certainly, you know, be our first choice as the judge. But here we have a technicality. Is here the Chachamim say that lo matzi hadar be, that the very moment that the litigants accepted upon themselves that this great judge would serve as their judge, that's binding, that's irreversible, according to the Chachamim. Why? Mishum di Abba v'Avicha chazu li alma. Because as far as Abba and Avicha is concerned, that we're accepted as judges, although in this case they're obviously disqualified according to Torah law because they're relatives, but chazu, they are appropriate, or they're suitable, li alma, for the whole world, meaning for any other case that would come up in judgment. And therefore, what the statement of Neman Alai Abba is, that I accept my father, is what it accomplishes is it removes that technical barrier. In other words, we're not dealing with an issue of the essential qualities or knowledge, expertise of judgment of the judge. All those he checks off. You know, he has a big smicho nation klaf, you know, hanging in his thing. He's a great judge. And in any other case on the face of the earth, he would be qualified to judge. But there's a technicality here because of the relative situation. So on that, they can neutralize that psul of what? Of a relative. And the Chacham say, once they've done so, then the father is already appointed, and the appointment is absolutely binding and irreversible.
If he can be, he's accepted and can be.
And now when the litigant says, no, I changed my mind, that's the Chacham say that's irrelevant, right? And that would be if I only had the second Mishnah. But what would I say about the first Mishnah? Aval chad kibetrei. In the first Mishnah, the litigant said, I accept one witness as if he were two witnesses. What would be the status of this one witness in any other case?
Wouldn't work.
Say it again?
It wouldn't work.
Correct. Divi aval lo chazin. Divi aval mean for all other cases, he's not suitable. He's not qualified to judge, to testify as one witness. Amai might think, modu leila Rabbi Meir. That in this case where the Neman Alai, you know, where he was Mekabel on himself, one aid as if he was two witnesses, he's creating a whole new entity which the Torah doesn't rely on. The Torah never recognized in any situation of monetary law the viability of one witness. And therefore, when you say, okay, he's believed for me, I'm going to accept him as a witness, you're really creating something that in the halachic universe is a non-entity. You're creating yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. So here I might think, if I only had the second Mishnah, and I didn't have the first Mishnah, that modu lei le Rabbi Meir, that the Chachama would admit to Rabbi Meir, that in this case the original statement is not fully binding, it's only temporarily binding, in such a way that if he decides he wants to pull it out, you know, pull the plug and say, no, I don't want to rely on one witness. One witness is not enough. That he has the power to do so. So we now have two Mishnayos, and if we only had the first Mishnah, we would not derive the second Mishnah. I need a Chiddush in the second Mishnah, and all this is according to the Chachamim of Rabbi Meir, to teach us that not only do the Chachamim say that it's absolutely binding and irrevocable when he accepts his father as a Dayan, and that makes sense because his father really is suitable to be a Dayan in all cases, so he overlooks and neutralizes the technicality, and that's binding. But even in a case where the litigant says, I'll rely on one witness, and if he testifies on your behalf, I'm willing to pay you as if he were two witnesses, where the statement declaration elevating one witness to the status of two is totally, totally antithetical to the halacha. The halacha doesn't even, in any situation, not just in this, but in any case, would not recognize one witness as two witnesses. Even so, the chachamim, and that's the chiddush of our Mishnah, would say it's irreversible. He cannot, the litigant cannot reverse his original commitment in which he declared that one witness is believed like two witnesses. So now we have the following problem. Okay, if we only had the second Mishnah, we would not know the first Mishnah. But what about the other way around? Let's say we had the first Mishnah. Then for sure we would not need the second Mishnah. If in the first Mishnah, where the litigant, by accepting one witness as two, has created a whole new entity that undermines the whole regulations here, because one witness is never, ever, ever believed in monetary law, and yet the Chachamim say that once he made that commitment, the litigant made that declaration, he cannot reverse it, and how much more so in the case of a litigant in the second Mishnah where he says that I'm going to accept my father as a judge. That's a very serious commitment, much more serious than saying one witness is like two, because his father is qualified as a judge for all cases except for this one. I don't need the Chachamim to tell me in the second Mishnah that ain't yochel lachzor, that he cannot reverse his original position. If he can't reverse his original position in the case where he just made a statement to create something of one witness like two witnesses, which is nothing, then how much more so when he accepts his father as a judge? So why do I need the second Mishnah? So the Gemara now finishes it all out. V'i ashmein beha. If the Tana would have only told me the first Mishnah, which is the case where the litigant accepted one witness as what? As two witnesses, is Ama, I might think, Beha. Only in that case of one witness like two, Ka'amar Rabbi Meir, there Rabbi Meir says that he can reverse his decision. Why? Because the Torah doesn't recognize one witness as two witnesses, Amal Be'ahi. But in the second Mishnah, where he accepts the status of his father and qualifies him as a judge, there the Torah does recognize that person, namely his father, as a judge in all cases except for this one. Ama, I would have thought, that in this case where the statement of the litigant accepting his father as a judge is just to remove that, neutralize that technicality here, but the father himself, in and of himself, is roiled, I would say that in such a case there's no backs touch blacks. You know, you've already made your commitment and you can't rescind it. Tricha, if I need the second Mishnah. So again, it comes out that I need the first Mishnah for a Chiddush in the Chachamim, that Eino Yochel Lachzor Bo, even though he created this status of an aid, which one aid is two aid, which is nothing. And I need the second Mishnah as a Chiddush for Rabbi Meir, that even though the father is basically fundamentally qualified as a judge in all cases except for this one, nevertheless, the litigant can rescind and revoke his original state. So far we're doing pretty good. If you followed me until now, again, if I were you and I was really interested in knowing this Gemara, I would mamish write myself a summary of this Gemara in my own handwriting. I'm not joking. I'm not saying that just now. So now the Gemara rejects Reish Lakish. Again, all of Reish Lakish was built on one premise, that in the first Mishnah, when Rabbi Meir says that he can disqualify, he was disqualifying how many witnesses? One. Right? So we're taking the word Edov and we're changing it to Edo in the singular. The Gemara says, I can't accept that. Why? Hamidik Tani Reisha. Let's go back to the Reisha. The Reisha was speaking about a case where Reuven presented the candidacy of a certain fellow as a dayan, and Shimon says, I object. And the Mishnah in the Reisha says, Ze posel dayano. Shelzeh. The word Dayano means his judge. And that's written in the singular grammatical form. And the Sefer, the Mishnah went out of its way to say, Zeh posel edav shelzeh, that he disqualifies the two witnesses. In other words, it's quite clear from the language of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, as he edited the Mishnah, that he's being very meticulous, and he is deliberately either using the plural or the singular. And here, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in the Mishnah, both the Reish of the Sefer is using the... No, I'm sorry. And the rule of contrast applies. That's what I meant to say. That if in the Reisha he went out of his way, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, to use the word Dayano Shelzeh, which means a singular Dayan, then in the Sefer, when he went out of his way to say a dove, he obviously meant two witnesses. Alma Dafka Ketani. We see that the author of the Mishnayos, of the Mishnah, that's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, was very medagdic, he was very meticulous about his choice of language. And if he uses the word Edov in the Sefer, in a plural grammatical form, then he means it as plural. We're talking about two witnesses. Right? Because, again, we're holding now like Rabbi Meir, that he can passel what the Baal Din HaSheni brought. What did the Baal Din HaSheni bring? He brought two witnesses. Comes along Rabbi Meir and he says that he has the power to disqualify two witnesses. Now at this point, Rabbi Osai, the whole sugya takes a turn in a different direction, and we completely reject Reish Lakish, which means that right now we're reading the Mishnah very carefully, and when it says a dove, we're talking about the plural and it's two witnesses, and Rabbi Meir says that the Baal Din, the litigant, can say, I don't accept these two witnesses. And now we're back to the Pek Hadosh. You know, how could it be that a holy mouth would say that the litigant can reject the testimony of two litigants? And again, we're not going with Rabbi Yochanan, who says that we're talking about Archos Shebesuria, because Archos Shebesuria would be relevant in terms of Dayanim. You know, that maybe Rabbi Meir would say that since we don't know that these judges in Syria are experts in the law, we give them the right to disqualify him. But now we're talking about witnesses. So how could it be that Rabbi Meir allows such a powerful tool in the hands of the litigant that he can disqualify two witnesses and say, these witnesses are unacceptable? So at this point, the Gemara introduces Rabbi Elazar. Now, Rabbi Meir said that the Baal Din could passel the Edim, the two witnesses of the other litigant. Omar Rabbi Elazar, Biba hu v'acher leposlan. It's not like we thought that one litigant comes forward and says that these two witnesses are disqualified. But rather, the Baal Din, the litigant, we'll call him Shimon, brings in another witness. And the two of them together testify against these two witnesses that they are psulim. And in this case, we have what's called a stalemate. We have tre utre, two against two. So again, according to Rabbi Elazar, A, it's clear that Rabbi Meir is talking about a case where we're disqualifying, where the litigant is believed to disqualify two witnesses. But on the other hand, it's clear that he as a single, as a one-man show, doesn't have the power to disqualify two witnesses. But rather, he comes with another witness, and together they both testify against the first two witnesses, meaning the witnesses that Reuven brought against Shimon, that they are psulim. And now he's believed. Now, are you happy with that, Rabbi Osai?
No, it's a litigant plus one witness.
Yeah. So can a litigant passel the edim, the two edim of the other litigant, because he is supported by the testimony of one other witness? What would you say? Does that make sense?
No.
No, it makes no sense at all, because He can't serve as a witness. If you have two witnesses and you want to get two against two, you're going to need two witnesses. But he, the litigant, cannot serve as a witness. He may know that these two witnesses perjured themselves, or they violated the Shabbos or something, but he can't testify because he's what's called a nogea b'edus. Right, again, I would write that on the board. Nogea b'edus means he has vested interests. And he can't testify in a case where he has vested interests. But that's what the Gemara immediately asks. Kol kamine, can this litigant serve as a witness together with one other witness to disqualify the two witnesses of the other litigant? Does he have such a power? As a rhetorical question, no gea b'edusohu. He has vested interests over here. No gea means he's going to gain by this testimony. You can't testify on your own behalf. You're a litigant. You're not a witness. Right, because what's he saying? He's saying that the first two witnesses that were brought by Reuven to testify against him, against Shimon, that he has to pay $1,000. Well, those witnesses were psulim. They were disqualified. They were guilty of sin, let's say. Well, how can you testify in a case where you're on trial and you're being sued for $1,000 and you're going to disqualify his witnesses? As what? As a witness? What status do you have as a witness? You are a nogea b'edus. Nogea b'edus. You can imagine it. If in every case that you sue me for money, I can testify that I don't have to pay you. That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, how can you accept the testimony of someone when he himself stands to gain by that testimony? That's called the nogea b'edus. Omar Rav Acha b'reid Rav Ika kigon. What's the case? Shakara olav arar. Now, Kara Olaf literally means they called upon him. Arar means some sort of a suspicion. You know, we have a phrase in English, when there's smoke, there's fire. And there's already some sort of a rumor going out there that these witnesses are not so on the up and up. Their reputation is somewhat tainted by an arar, some sort of a question about their status. You know, somebody has already, you know, registered his complaint against them. So there's a rumor going around, let's say, that these witnesses are not on the up and up. So Gemara says arar demai. What is the content, the substance of this rumor? Elam, if you're going to tell me, is Arar de Gazlanusa, that maybe there's some sort of a, a suspicion that they are thieves, and now this litigant is going to testify, well, I know that he's a thief. And he's going to get together with his buddy, with another colleague. Is called Kamine? Just because he's claiming that I saw him steal something? Once again, no gabe do so who. You've got to somehow set up the testimony of the litigant as objective. You follow what I mean by objective? Meaning he has no negia, he has no vested interest. Well, once he's testifying against these witnesses that they are thieves, and therefore you cannot accept their testimony, he's therefore exempting himself from any sort of a payment. So the Gemara says, "Ela arar depgam mishpacha." Right, we'll try to wrap this up very quickly. What's arar de pagam mishpacha? That he's testifying against someone that he's posel mitzad mishpachto. Now, this psul is what we call a psul of yuchsin. This is not relevant to testimony per se. It could be relevant to who this person is allowed to marry. Now what happens is, back in the day, there were all sorts of rumors going around about a certain mishpacha that avadim, that non-Jewish blood, somehow got mixed into this family. And that has tremendous repercussions. As I said, let's say you want to marry a member of this family, and there's an ara'ar, there's some sort of a rumor going around that this family is not pure Jewish blood. You know, there are avodim that got mixed up into the family. You know, this reminds me a little bit of Hanukkah, because as far as the Hashmonaim are concerned, historically, there was a whole question over the course of time, way after the miracle of Hanukkah, about the lineage of the Hashmonaim, because some slaves and so forth married into the family. Anyway, if you learn Masechta Ksuvos, you'll see there's something called Arar Mishpacha. And Arar Mishpacha is relevant to primarily marriage law. Who's allowed to marry? Let's say, for example, a Kohen would want to marry a girl from this family, and there are rumors about this family that there's an admixture of non-Jewish blood in the family, that some avodim married into the family, and this girl might be the product of a mixed marriage. How can a Kohen allowed to be married? Now, if this mishpacha is actually determined or condemned, if you want to use the word, to be psulim, to have this psul mishpacha, psul, then they can't testify as well. So one of the most fundamental repercussions is that you can't marry into the family. But there's another repercussion, and that is that the members of these family are no longer qualified as witnesses, because they don't have that yuchsin, the lineage that's necessary. So now, imagine, Reuven in this monetary case brings two witnesses into Beis Din to testify that Shimon owes him 1,000. Shimon, together with another witness, says that I know that these two witnesses belong to families which are questionable, and we cannot accept them as witnesses. Rabbi Meir Sovereign says that we can accept the claim and the testimony of the litigant. And that's not called Ogea Biedus. It's not vested interest. Why? Because Hani, these witnesses, meaning he himself, the litigant, together with his buddy, Amishpacha Kamisade. They're not testifying against these two witnesses. They don't know if these two witnesses had a relationship with an Eved or not. They're testifying on the Mishpacha Kamisade. They are testifying Amishpacha on the whole family. The EU and these witnesses, Mimela Kapasil, as a result of the testimony on the family, which is relevant to every single member of that family and its lineage, these two individuals, insofar as they're part of that family, now become disqualified as witnesses.
Pretty broad stroke.
Say it again, one more time.
Broad stroke. They're puzzled away from the fact of their association with their family, let alone.
But since the testimony is not on these two individuals per se, but on the whole mishpacha, right? Let's call it mishpachas chanuchi, right? So there's testimony now against this chanuchi family and all its lineage that there's an admixture of non-Jewish blood in the family. Now, two members of that family, or let's say they testify against two families, come forward with testimony. The litigant is not testifying against these two witnesses per se. That he can't do, because they're testifying that he owes 1,000, they don't get aids. But he's testifying against the families from which they come. And that's acceptable. For Rabban and Savri, and this is where we're going to end it for today, the Chacham disagree with Rabbi Meir, and they say, Sof no gebi edusu. At the end of the day, as a result of this testimony, that these two witnesses that are being adduced by Reuven belong to families that are psulim, the litigant is now saving himself 1,000 zuz, right? Because the witnesses now are disqualified. We can't accept, even if the testimony has a much broader implication, but if it also has implications about this particular case and the monetary payment or lack thereof in this particular case, they still remain no gea biedus. And therefore the Rabbanan say that we cannot accept the testimony of the litigant. So Rabbosa, if we take a step back and we just summarize, you know, we thought that Rabbi Meir was saying that a litigant can disqualify witnesses who are coming to testify against him. How could such a holy mouth like Rabbi Meir make such a statement? But now we've cut it down to a much more sophisticated and sensitive question about the litigants who are testifying not against these two witnesses per se, but against the family. And the question is, do we view that in terms of its ultimate repercussions, which means that therefore these two witnesses, insofar as they belong to that family, are disqualified as witnesses, then he becomes an Oger B'Eidus? Or do we say no, that we look at it as testimony on the families, you know, for all the repercussions therein? And the fact that as a result, these two guys are now apostolates, that's not really the subject that's being addressed, and therefore the witnesses are kosher. That's Rabbi Meir Shita. We've completely, radically changed our understanding of Rabbi Meir. Okay then? So Molinetta will pick this up again tomorrow at 8:30.
Tomorrow's going to be
tomorrow.